Good morning. Good morning. Just one quick point. As much as this class really is to I guess counteract to a certain extent, or just remove some of the angst that we get when we see some of these sources that are often provided by missionaries. These are some of the basic go-to sources. It's just really to diffuse the situation. So as much as this is a very critical and important point, I do want to also make the point that, at least in my very limited experience, there are many, many Gentiles, many good Christians out there who don't seem ostensibly to have the kind of agenda that some of these sources would lead you to believe. I have a very, very positive, I think. I mean, I don't know what's really going on in his mind. I would like to think, I would hope that he thinks that I'm damned. I mean, that means that I'm being a good Jew. But I'd like to believe that that's the case. But I have Sarah and I enjoy a very wonderful relationship with our neighbors. We have very frum Catholic neighbors. Very frum. It happens to be that he is very, very interested in Judaism. And, you know, we talk a lot. And he volunteered to help me build my sukkah. So he's just very, very interested. I mean, he's really interested in understanding our perspective of Hebrew scriptures, of what they would call the Old Testament, of what we would call the Only Testament. So there does exist. I don't want to paint the picture that all is lost in our ability to maintain pleasant and cordial relations with members of other faiths. But certainly, at least as far as taking a look at some of our own sources, which are often drawn upon by missionaries and missionary types, it's important to understand them in a more truthful manner than they are often portrayed. Having said that, you know what, I didn't even hand these out. My apologies. We can give these a little go. What's going to be coming around are two sheets. And I would ask you, as you get this one, and I'll just offer an introduction as to what this sheet is all about. This sheet is part of an email that I received by an actual congregant of ours, of this shul, who was sent this by a colleague or friend that he has. He's a good friend. He obviously cares for him very deeply. He's concerned that he's going to, you know, burn in purgatory or whatever. So he sent this to him in an attempt to sway him and to see the light and to understand the truth of Jesus, at least as Messiah. I don't know about as a divine deity, God, whatever, but at least as Messiah. Now, this just struck me as being a really nice compilation of, I forget the actual number. I think it's something like 67 sources, I believe. 61 sources. Yeah, 61 different sources from our scriptures. This is from Tanakh. This is from our Jewish Bible that clearly and unmistakably point to Jesus as the Messiah.
Depends on the translation.
Who knew it was there the whole time? So we'll have to work through it, but absolutely unequivocally. So we'll work through this list. What I'd like you to do is just take a couple of minutes as it's coming around. You don't have to, this first side is just an introduction. When we start quoting, just take a quick scan through the first few paragraphs here and just take note of the information that we actually are presented with. Some of these sources may be familiar, but just give a quick look. Some of them may be familiar. Some of them may be unfamiliar as far as references made in our Bible. But just take a quick look at them so you understand the terrain.
The first few are reasonable.
They're all reasonable. They're all, almost all. There's one that's really crazy that I came across. But most of them are fair translations. Psalm 22. We got a lot of favorites here. We got, right, they pulled a lot off the, you know, many of them are from the greatest hits, you know? Yaakov, we got a couple of source sheets up here. Okay, so that, I didn't really give enough time, but I'm just worried about having to edit the audio later. Okay, you get the point. Now, some of them are similar, some of them are repetitive, but they all point to various things that we're told or we understand, I guess, from Christian sources happened over the course of Jesus' life. And here we have in our scriptures, right, in our Tanakh, points that seem to indicate that if Jesus really accomplished these things, then surely, certainly, he is the Messiah. Wonderful. I think first and foremost, what we need to take stock of is that it can just be overwhelming being hit with all of these sources. Now, here they are on a nice piece of paper, and you can sort of chew on them and think them over. Understand, when this happens over the course of a conversation with a missionary or a Jews for Jesus or whomever it may be, when it comes across in conversation, it's just incredibly overwhelming. And it's not as though we all walk around with a Tanakh in our back pocket. And if you're anything like me, then your knowledge of Tanakh and the Hebrew Bible is not what it should be. And I very much include myself in that category. Unfortunately, in yeshiva, we spend not enough time actually studying the Bible. It's much more Talmudic focused. But at any rate, it's just very overwhelming. You hear somebody who's hitting you with source after source after source, and you're not really in position to refute them. So here we have it on a piece of paper, and here we have some time to actually go through at least some of these together and get something of an idea. So with this laid as the background, some of these sources that you have, let us go to the actual packet. Now, just a couple of sources that we actually already spoke about last week. These come from Maimonides as far as the qualifications that are necessary for us in terms of Jewish law to determine that somebody might possibly be the Messiah. Both are very, very important. We saw both of these last week, but just as a review. So first of all, source number one. This comes from Hilchos Malachim, the Laws of Kings, chapter 12, halacha number 2. First source. And there are those amongst sages who say that Elijah will come before the coming of the Messiah. This is the Rambam is sort of engaged in the conversation. When does Elijah come? What role does Elijah the prophet play in the messianic development, in the messianic era? Does he come before the Messiah? Does he come after the Messiah? Etc. He says, we don't really know, but all these matters and those like them, one cannot really know how they will happen until they happen. For these matters were concealed amongst the prophets. Even the sages had no tradition regarding these matters, only their ability to interpret the verses of the Bible. Now, the Rambam continues by saying that, therefore, we shouldn't be too wrapped up and we shouldn't be too caught up in contemplating the Messianic era and trying to derive any sort of real clear knowledge from the verses that we might have in the Bible, because the fact is they're very vague. And I think that is critical, point number one. No matter what verse anybody will throw at you, the fact of the matter is, nowhere, certainly in the five books of Moses, which is fascinating, nowhere do we find any overt reference to the Messiah. And even throughout the Tanakh, we have passages that we consider to be prophecies that detail some of the aspects of the Messianic era. But again, very vague, very obscure, and that's exactly how it should be. Has anybody in here ever experienced a prophecy? So I'll tell you what it's like. It's unclear. It's vague. And that's certainly the and even if it is clear on some level and it resonates with the prophet himself, the ability to then explain to others exactly what has happened can be very, very difficult. Very difficult. The images, the messages that are received. So the notion of whatever Isaiah may have seen about the Messianic era becomes very difficult to convey to others. And that's what we find in the Bible. It's very difficult to understand, very difficult for us, certainly, to interpret. That's point number one. Yeah, Susan?
Rabbi, would you explain what Tanakh is?
Oh, I'm sorry. Tanakh is the Bible. Tanakh stands for, it's an acronym. Torah. Torah refers to the five books of Moses. The Nun is Nevi'im, the prophets. And then the Chaf is Ketuvim, which are other writings. So we use the acronym Tanakh to refer to our book, the 24 books of the Jewish Bible, as we have them. Some of the other things that are included in, some of the books that are included in Nevi'im and the prophets are Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, etc. Jeremiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Some of the other writings that are included in Ketuvim and the writings are some sort of historical and others just writings, like the Psalms or like Proverbs, but also things like Esther and things like Daniel and things like Ruth. So those are, that's the divide. We refer to all three collectively as the Bible or as Tanakh. Taf, Nun, Chaf, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim.
Thank you.
You got it. Thank you. I apologize. Please feel free to stop me if I say any more terms that are totally unfamiliar. I'm sorry. Okay, bottom source. All right, this also comes from the Laws of Kings, from Hilchos Malachim, chapter 11, Halacha 4. Now, here we have the actual qualifications. We saw this again last time, but just really important to keep in mind. So critical to keep in mind. And if a king will arise from the house of David, who is, number one, house of David, right? House of David, okay. Who is learned in Torah and performs the mitzvot as David his ancestor. So he has to abide by the same corpus of law. What does that mean? That means according to the, number one, written law, and number two, the oral law. And influences all of Israel to go in the way of Torah. So certainly, anybody who is either not from the house of David, or does not, at least in Maimonides' formulation, his understanding, a more traditional Jewish perspective, certainly somebody who himself veers from the path of mainstream, for lack of a better term, orthodoxy, certainly somebody who, one of the qualifications is an ability to bring others closer towards that path, not someone who will create something of a rebellion and lead people off to another path. So he influences Israel to go in the way of Torah, to be punctiliously observant, and he fights the wars of God, also has to be a general. There's actually a physical fight that takes place that will be necessary. He is then presumed to be the Messiah. Now, keep going. If he does so, and he's successful, and is victorious against all the surrounding nations, so he actually leads this war, and he's successful, then builds the temple in its place, gathers the scattered Jews, then he is certainly the Messiah. Okay? Not asking for much. Well, so big deal, right? And if he is not successful to this extent, or he is killed, it is known that this is not the one that the Torah has promised. He is like all the other exemplary, valid kings of the house of David who died, right? David was also a Messiah in the sense that he was anointed as king. So, by the way, it seems that you can be anointed as king, but still not be the Messiah. So we might rally behind you and say, you are our king, we'll follow you, but if he doesn't build the temple, not the Messiah. Sorry, too bad. If he's killed, not the Messiah. We mentioned last time. Think of it as a status, a degree, right? If a person is a PhD candidate, but unfortunately passes away before he completes it, you can't have doctor written on your tombstone. It just doesn't work like that, right? If you finish the PhD, then no matter when you die, at whatever point, you still go down in history as having that doctorate, and that's your status that you've achieved. The difference is that you can actually pass this on to your kid. So, a little bit different. There is an absolutely fascinating book that I'm still in the middle of called Constantine's Sword. Okay, some of you may have read it. Fascinating book.
Yeah.
What is the most fascinating about it? This was written by a guy named James Carroll. James Carroll is a former Catholic priest who, for a whole host of reasons, opted out of the priesthood. Not the least of which is he likes girls. thank God, not a problem if you're a rabbi. Right?
That's an oddity, isn't it?
It's not an oddity. That's the problem. Unfortunately, it's actually it's pretty pervasive. Wrote an absolutely fascinating book about the history of the Jews and the church. Now, the most fascinating part of this book is that, inexplicably, he still considers himself a Catholic. I can't figure it out.
Yeah,
it's like every page is just dripping with every reason in the world to drop out of Catholicism. But for whatever, he's, I guess, sort of a Catholic by unconventional definitions, I guess. But at any rate, really, really interesting book. He has a general theme that he speaks about throughout the entire book, and here is one particular quote that really deals with it. Okay, but the excerpt just given, perhaps reflecting the darkness of the later Augustine, don't worry about all the historical information here, we're building towards a specific point, nevertheless points to the precarious position in which Jews now found themselves. The irony in this passage is heartbreaking, as the entire misbegotten pattern of the Jewish-Christian disconnect is recapitulated. Those first grief-struck followers of Jesus had created a narrative of his passion and death, in part out of reports of what had happened, but more out of the consoling scriptures of their Jewish religion. This is a point that he makes throughout the book. What religion was Jesus?
Jewish.
The first followers of Jesus were?
Jewish.
The first notion of following Jesus was then a Jewish splinter sect.
Right.
Okay? What scriptures were they turning to? What scriptures did they study?
Tanakh,
Torah. Now, Tanakh wasn't necessarily completed yet, but certainly, you know, as we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, basically parallel. Nevi'im and Ketuvim were certainly around, but whether or not the complete edited version, the finally canonized version, was necessarily, at what point that necessarily came to pass, sort of irrelevant. The fact is, there were these texts that Jews were turning to. They were turning to those same texts. His point, and he makes it again and again, and it's a fascinating one, is that in coming up with the notion of what then became later known as the New Testament, in crafting this narrative of Jesus, let me pull back for 1 second here. You know, there is a distinction between Chumash and Medrash. Okay? Chumash is God's word. Okay? Medrash is the word of the rabbis, in part based upon certain traditions that may have been passed down, in part based on certain interpretations of the actual Chumash, the verses of the Torah itself. But oftentimes what we find is that the rabbis created a narrative of Abraham. Now, how do you create a narrative of Abraham if you never knew the guy, you weren't there to witness it? Well, it depends. If they are interested in highlighting a particular value of Abraham that we know through tradition, or in framing Abraham's life in a particular way so that it will be relevant for whatever era they lived in or beyond, they may construct a narrative that draws upon other aspects of the Torah, other aspects of the Jewish religion, etc., in order to convey that message. Doesn't mean it's false at all, by any means, God forbid. It is just another method of interpretation, another method of education. And it's very artistic, right? That to take certain basic core values of Judaism and to infuse them into a narrative about those who, let's say, founded the religion. The early Christians, says Carroll, and other scholars, did the exact same thing. Imagine that the man that you are heralding and putting up on a pedestal as the Messiah or greater suddenly dies in a horribly grotesque fashion. What do you do with yourself now? How do you live another day? How do you go on? So you turn to the same texts that all Jews turn to for comfort and for consolation. You turn to the Hebrew Scriptures. And in trying to appease and assuage some of your, not guilt, but to try to make yourself feel better about all that has been lost, you construct a narrative that sort of realizes Jesus as the Messiah based upon the Hebrew Scriptures. I've always turned to these Hebrew Scriptures and they've pointed towards a specific Messiah. So I do that again and I write a narrative about Jesus that, conveniently enough, places him in that exact same position. Is it embellished? Is it a bit fanciful? Absolutely. But there's no shame in that. Meaning it's taking who they believed to be the leader, the greatest leader, and they are creating a version of his having realized all of the great Jewish dreams and prophecies that are spoken about in our text and in our own prophets and our own scriptures. So what happens? The problem is that all too soon, he continues, that creative narration had come to be understood as history remembered instead of prophecy historicized. Two really, really important terms. Prophecy historicized means that at some point the scriptures as we find them will actually take place, right? It will actually become history. That wasn't what happened with Jesus, even in the minds of the early Christians. It wasn't as though Jesus was the fulfillment of all of these predictions and all of these prophecies. Instead, it was history remembered instead of prophecy historicized. I actually just flipped the terms. History remembered means that this actually happened. This was history. Right? This is what actually took place, as opposed to saying that we look at the prophecies and we create some sort of historical narrative, kind of like historical fiction, a little bit predicated on what the prophets actually said, and we say that that guy was Jesus. A little bit embellished, a couple of white lies here and there, but with a purpose, with a plan, not just to dupe and deceive, but in order to paint Jesus in that particular light, much perhaps in the way that we might create some kinds of midrashic literature. So they created a medrash almost of Jesus, but that's not to say that this was actually historical. It's not meant to be historical. It's meant to be like a medrash, where you learn it and there are lessons and there are values that were meant to glean from it. But it doesn't mean that everything necessarily happened exactly as it was.
And they would be familiar with midrash.
They would be familiar with it. Think about the consolation. They would be familiar with midrashim.
Right.
They would be familiar with the Jewish scriptures. And they were familiar with those, right, this whole genre of study, of education, etc., was something that they would be very much familiar with.
So
exactly.
You're talking something didactic rather than real.
Bidiyuk, yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. Okay, so it's not meant to be historical, it's meant to be didactic, it's meant to be a means of educating, whether it's the masses or even just their own, as to the validity of Jesus in the way that they sort of understood it, but dialing it back into the scriptures. Again, not necessarily in a totally accurate historical way, but in a way that was very meaningful, in a way that really rooted what Jesus did in the Hebrew scriptures. Not to take away, but just to embellish and to add on. Now that becomes very important when we read through some of these sources, because what we have is a collection of 61 sources that say that it's like incredible. Look at all of these prophecies, and Jesus did all these things. How do we know that Jesus did all these things? Where is it written that Jesus did all these things? In the New Testament. Who wrote the New Testament, or whatever, yeah, call it what you will, right? In the Christian Chvesvas, right? In the thing. in the Christian book. How do we know that he did? Who wrote that?
A bunch of guys 100 years later,
based upon traditions that they had received from people 100 years earlier, who were making a concerted effort to, again, prophecy historicized, not history remembered. The notion was to take the prophecies and to make them quasi-historical, to speak about Jesus in that kind of context. And here we find a prophecy that maybe has something to do with the Messianic era. Well, wouldn't it just be marvelous if this is something that Jesus accomplished over the course of his life? Again, not necessarily to dupe and deceive any more than a medrash that is clearly out there is not meant to necessarily be historically accurate, but is meant to convey a particular lesson. By painting Jesus in that sort of light, you are making the statement that this man is the Messiah. Did he necessarily fulfill that prophecy that we find? Doesn't make a difference. Right? The fact is, we have enough to work with. He was such a captivating leader and such a fascinating scholar and such a lovely, wonderful person. We have enough to work with. Now let's also dial him into some additional prophecies that perhaps he never touched.
They also weren't writing for Jews.
Probably not. We don't really know. It's hard to say.
They're writing for, right.
So this first group was very much Jewish. This first group was very much Jewish. As Christianity continues to evolve, it takes on a decidedly pagan bent. Remember that Jesus goes from a Mashiach, which is a very extraordinarily Jewish concept, to being a part of a Trinity, which is God, which is a decidedly non-Jewish concept and a wholly pagan concept. I mean, whether or not we even consider that to be monotheism is debated amongst Jewish scholars. Maimonides was of the opinion that it wasn't. It just wasn't. Still isn't, right? Now, here's where it becomes really, here's where it becomes critical. Now, that's one notion that we have to sort of keep in the backdrop, that those things that we know about Jesus in the first place were not necessarily written to be historical. Right, they were written to be, it's not the word of God, it was absolutely written by human beings. And the bent of those human beings may have just been to, again, embellish upon the story of Jesus to make it a little bit more messianic. Okay, that's number one. Number two, many of what we find here in these sources are, I mean, to say benign is almost an understatement. Many of them, at least, to, and I'm not even talking about, well, from a Jewish tradition, this isn't really messianic. I think what I'd like to leave you with most today is the ability, and that doesn't mean that we're ending right now, but is the ability or the confidence to know, please, by all means, everyone should have one of these, whether it's this one or another edition. There shouldn't be anybody in this room without an English translated Jewish Bible. Tanakh, right? Everyone's got to have one of these. Okay, if you don't have one now, go on Amazon when you go home. The Art Scroll, with the exception of one book, is really an excellent one and a half is really an excellent version. But really, really worth having. Really, very much worth having. I want to leave everybody with the confidence to pull one of these off the shelves, and just when you come across these sorts of things, take a look for yourself and think about it. You know, that's the point. It can be extremely. The person who sent this to me said, "I don't know what to do with this. Like, how do I respond to this?" It's overwhelming. 61 sources. Oh my God, Jesus is everywhere. It's like you read through Bereshit, and there's Jesus. He was created on the eighth day. And Noah, and Jesus was on the boat with Noah. I had no idea. Oh my God, I can't believe it. And there were three angels, and Jesus also came into the tent of Abraham. Who had a clue? Wow, I can't believe it. He's everywhere. But if you actually start to pull a Tanakh off the shelves, you see that many of the things that we come across are totally benign or have absolutely nothing to do with any sort of messianic prophecy whatsoever. So either they're almost there's almost misdirection, just doesn't have anything to do with the Messiah, or benign in the sense that, as we just mentioned, the Messiah is going to come from the house of David, right? So maybe Jesus also came from the house of David. Okay, maybe I come from the house of David. It's plausible. It's very possible. There are probably people sitting in this room who come from the house of David, right? That doesn't mean that you're the Messiah. Sorry. Some other qualifications also. But again, benign. So what I'd like to do first, just to give a couple of examples, there are a couple of chapters of the Psalms that are quoted, and one particular chapter in Isaiah that I would like to take a look at first, and then if we have some additional time to kind of go through some of these other sources. But more than anything, that is what that's really the take-home message here. Feel confident to pull a Bible off the shelf and actually read through it and question yourselves. Does this speak about a Messiah or not? If it does speak about a Messiah, does it speak about anybody in particular? If it does speak about somebody in particular, is that person Jesus or any other figure, or is it Shabtai Tzvi, or is it whomever else that may be purported to be the Messiah, even though he's dead? Okay, take a look at page 763 in the Bible here. Take a look at Psalm 2. Now, this is often looked at as being a messianic prophecy. I've heard Jews for Jesus speak about this. I'm like a lightning rod for Jews for Jesus. I don't know why. Part of it is that I actually bear a striking physical resemblance to a lightning rod. And then there's also the fact that I got the yarmulke and the tzitzis on, so they're very, very excited. And, so also, and Miriam, I feel so bad to do this to you, but there's a specific reason why I, and I think it's important for everybody, there's a specific reason why I asked you guys to be here today also. In that, first of all, this is like one of the last opportunities that we have with you in a formal context, right before you go off to college. These are the kinds of things that you encounter. I've heard stories from people whose kids have gone to college, and they start hearing these things, and not in a missionary type of context or setting. Just you develop relationships with people who certainly are going to be Christian. I mean, unless you're going to YU or Stern or something like that. But you're going to be developing relationships with people who are Christian. And college is a time when people are exploring and wondering and questioning, as well they should. And it becomes one of the first opportunities where you're sort of like on your own. And people start talking about Jesus. And I don't know, like, why don't I believe in Jesus? I really like Christmas. Great sales. I look great in green and red. You know, why not? And it becomes very, very confusing. So the idea here, and Miriam, not just for you, but also to sort of spread the word. Feel free to hold on to this. Feel free to make copies of this. And to go through this exercise on your own when you have a little bit more time. But to spread the word to others you might know in that sort of context, in that sort of setting, that feel confident to go through the list with an open Bible and just get a sense. Like, what is this really saying anything that is so overtly pointing to Jesus or anyone else, or is it not? And obviously, you know my feelings on the topic. Okay, so here is one prime example. Again, Psalm 2. So this is on page 763 of the photocopied Tanakh, this Bible that we have. Second Psalm. Why do nations gather and regimes talk in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the princes conspire secretly against the Lord and against his anointed. You're already starting to get from the picture that we have, right, of the passion of Jesus, the whole the whole story of how he was, there was subterfuge and how he was conspired against and one of his own turned him in and all of that. And finally, he was actually destroyed by, let's say, a tag team somehow between the Jews and the Romans, perhaps. So here we have, they conspire secretly against the Lord and against his anointed. By the way, one of the best points that I've ever heard made by a very well-known anti-Jews for Jesus person, Rabbi Tuvia Singer, made the point that, no, against the Lord and against his anointed.
The Jews.
No, meaning two different, even looking at this from saying this is talking about Jesus, two different beings,
right.
Lord and anointed. Two different concepts, two different beings. But even forgetting about the whole divinity aspect to Jesus, just thinking about this as being, speaking about him as the Messiah. Okay? So you get why Christians would point to this as being a source. Standing up against the Lord and his anointed. So if Jesus, it's very circular, let it be assumed that Jesus is the anointed. Okay. Let's say... So if he's the anointed, then you understand how this perhaps is speaking about the whole passion of Jesus. Let us cut their cords and let us cast off the ropes from ourselves. He who sits in heaven will laugh, the Lord will mock them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and in his wrath, he will terrify them. I myself have anointed my king. God says, I appointed Jesus over Zion, my holy mountain. I am obliged to proclaim that the Lord said to me, you are my son, I have begotten you today. Wow, really powerful. I have begotten you today. That means like a direct connection then between the Messiah, the anointed one, and having come directly, actually being the seed of the Lord, divine seed. I am obliged to proclaim that the Lord said to me, you are my son, I have begotten you today. Ask of me and I will make nations your inheritance and the ends of the earth your possession. You will smash them with an iron rod. You will shatter them like a potter's vessel. And now, O kings, be wise, be disciplined, O judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with awe so that you may rejoice when there is trembling. Yearn for purity lest he grow angry and your way be doomed. For in a brief moment his anger will blaze. Fortunate are all who trust in him. Jesus? No, I was calling on Jesus. Yeah, in the back. Jesus. No. Talking about Jesus or not?
When was this written?
This was written by King David.
I understand. When was Yoshka around?
Much later. Okay, so you're talking about pre-First Temple period. Now, what Christians will tell you is that... Oh, this kid's going to steal all my thunder. What Christians will tell you is that this was a prophecy. Right, King David was writing a prophecy about the Messiah ultimately realized in Jesus. But what I think you find, I mean, this just seems to me to be awfully benign for a couple of reasons. First of all, let it be talking about the Messiah. Is there any reason to assume that this is speaking about Jesus specifically? I mean, you know what, maybe it's unfair, but what I want, if you're really a prophet and you're going to prophesize and you're going to give me something that points absolutely unequivocally to the Jesus that we've come to know through the Christian stories and through the passion narrative and all of that, I want someone to talk about a crucifix. I mean, that other people stand in his way. Can we conceive of a Messiah who won't be degraded, who won't be degraded by Jews and Gentiles alike? I can't imagine such a thing. Is it even speaking about a Messiah? We speak about God's anointed one. You know, the Jewish people collectively, somebody mentioned it, the Jewish people collectively are often referred to as God's firstborn son, the anointed one. What does it mean to be an anointed? Who gets anointed? Actually, who in Judaism?
King.
King and?
Prophets.
And prophets, right? So it's like Joshua, and when Smicha was extant, there was that notion.
The
king.
Priest.
High priest, okay? Those who serve as educators for the masses, those who serve as role models for the masses, are anointed. Anointed means that you now have a role to fill where other people will look at you and want to learn from you and want to copy you. So the Jewish people as a whole fill that role vis-a-vis the other nations. We are meant to serve in that sort of capacity. We are God's anointed one towards the other nations. If that's the case, and again, it's just so vague, but let's assume for a second that it talks about the Jewish people as a whole. Isn't that spot on? that other people will stand up against us, other people will degrade us, other people will put us down. It's not going to be an easy role. It's not going to be simple. But ultimately, God says, I'll cut off their cords and I'll smash them and I'll break them. Yeah, messianic era, when finally people will look at the Jewish people, not again for our own kavod and our own glory and look at me and how wonderful I am, but that other people will turn towards the Jews as role models in the sense that I also want to serve God in that way. Well, not exactly that way. I could do without the schmaltering. But that I want to pray to God, monotheism, according to the Jewish definition. Yeah, woohoo, exciting, right? Again, it's just it's benign, circular. You have to already accept. When I think about proof, I think about something that, you know, it's proven independently, inherently and independently. I don't need to buy into some other corpus of beliefs in order for it to then be proven. I want it to be overt. Give it to me right here. Say that the Messiah will be someone who speaks out against the temple and insists that the new temple will be found within him and then will be crucified by some sort of foreign power. That to me would be proof. But unfortunately, fortunately, I guess.
Could be David referring to himself.
Could be David referring, and we'll see that again and again. Very often, David, by the way, was the Messiah. He was anointed at Mashiach. You know, it has the colloquial sort of connotation of, like, the Messiah, the end of days, the Messianic era. But again, Mashiach and Mashuach, anointed, you'll find throughout even the Chumash. The idea of specific people, the ones we've mentioned, being anointed in order to fulfill and fulfill their specific purpose and fill their specific role.
King.
Himself. Yeah. Makes sense?
Tried to take over
the
king before David even died.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Others standing up against him, his own son stands up against him. Right. Take a look at chapter 35. Now, something that I just want to point out, if I can find it quickly enough, because this is one that is often pointed to. I want to just see how he uses it. If you take a look, yeah. Just going back to 2 for a second. So in the midst of this first paragraph, we're given a quote from Psalm number 2. And we're told that the Messiah will be God the Father's son, right? Psalm 2 verse 7, which is what we just saw. But again, the Jewish people as a whole are often referred to as God's son, right? B'ni b'chori Yisrael, etc., right? That Israel is my firstborn. Could also be referring to David himself. We all like to consider ourselves sons of God. Now, one other point, this is really, really important. We saw Maimonides believes that the Messiah will have to be of the Davidic line, a direct descendant of David. Okay. We saw a chapter in Psalms just now that speaks about the Messiah or David, or maybe it's the Messiah, maybe it's the Jewish people, who knows, as being the Son of God. Okay, taking that literally for a second, how do we determine whether or not a Jew is a Jew? How do we make that assessment?
Mother.
If your mother's Jewish, then you're a Jew, right? How do we determine whether you are a Kohen, Levi, or Yisrael?
Father.
Your father. How do we determine if you're from the tribe, let's say, of Judah?
Father.
Your father. How do we determine if you are of the Davidic line?
Father.
Who is Jesus' father? Well, let's say God for a second. Let's buy into it, right? Let's buy into the fact that that Jesus didn't really have a human father. What we would call that in, and I wouldn't, honestly, this is almost so insulting that I wouldn't share this with any, you know, Gentile. But what that means is that Jesus essentially was a mamzer.
There you go.
A mamzer. A mamzer is like the halachic equivalent of a bastard. To be born without a father means that you have no tribe that you belong to. It means that you can't possibly be part of the Davidic line, because how can you trace your patrilineal descendancy back to David? It's impossible. There is no way to buy that Jesus was both of divine seed and also simultaneously of the Davidic line. You got to make up your mind. He was either a human being who could be the Messiah, but once you cross over the line and say that he was of divine origin and he himself is divine, no longer can he be the Messiah. Note that Maimonides, according to the Jewish view, understanding, interpretation, heritage, whatever, Messiah can't die before he does all the messianic stuff. But he'd better die afterwards. Right? He's going to die. Messiah isn't going to live forever. He's not going to be immortal. He's not going to be divine. He's going to die. It's just that he has certain things that he needs to accomplish beforehand. You cannot approach both. You cannot hold both beliefs simultaneously. It's impossible. Take a look at Psalm 35 by David. Oh Lord, contend with my adversaries. Fight those who do battle with me. Take hold of shield and buckler and rise up in my defense. And draw the spear and bar the way before my pursuers. Say to my soul, I am your salvation. May those who seek my life be shamed and disgraced. Let those who plot my harm retreat and be humiliated. Who's David talking about? David's talking about David. David's absolutely talking about David. This is a biography. Read about David in the book of Samuel, and this is what he had to rise up against. His own son tries to rebel against him. David's road to the throne wasn't exactly paved with yellow brick. It was horrible. He had Saul, who was out to kill him. Right. And rightfully so, because as far as Saul is concerned, he was, you know, trying to grab the throne. And he was trying to grab the throne, but he was supposed to grab the throne. But it was no easy climb. It was no easy path. It was arduous. It was difficult. It was impossible. David says, let those who rise up against me be struck down. David's talking about himself. So the idea that as some sort of proof text, I mean, if you want to tell me that it's talking about the Messiah and it's a Messiah that we all believe in or whatever, okay, I'm all right with that. But to prove to me from this that this is speaking about anybody other than David, it certainly doesn't sound that way. It certainly doesn't sound that way.
There's a lot of hacking.
Yeah, sure. Remember that David could not build the temple because of violence. Right, it was Solomon who has to build the temple, not David, because this isn't what we... David wasn't wrong. David had to do what he had to do. But the fact is, it affects you. Right, you become influenced by your own actions, your own deeds, your own life experiences. David had to fight these wars, but he became a man of war. And a man of war can't build a temple of peace. So it's a good point. It becomes very interesting then that, at least according to our tradition, it is exactly because David has all of this sort of violence in his career and in his path that he cannot build a temple, that we speak about a Messiah who has all this violence who's going to build a temple. It's a weird... We do have that. We do have that as our... In our messianic formulation, right, in Maimonides' formulation, we do have that. That the same guy who fights the battles also ultimately builds the temple of peace. But it's an unusual sort of guy.
I was reading another commentary analysis last night that also said that David couldn't build the temple because David was so revered that the temple would never be demolished, and that would have meant that David was the Messiah, but David isn't supposed to be the Messiah. So therefore, David couldn't build the temple.
That's very mystical. I don't even want to know what you were reading. Oh yeah, we say the same thing about Moses. Perhaps everyone tries to grasp at why it is that Moses wasn't allowed to come into the land. I mean, he hit the rock, really. So some say that it wouldn't have been good for the Jews had Moses come in, because whatever Moses did, think about Moses' speech is eternal, right? When Moses spoke, it was the Torah. When Moses built, it was forever. He was like, what's that, like De Beers, right? Like a diamond is forever. Moses was like the poster boy for De Beers. So if he were to build the temple would be forever. That's sort of a problem. God takes out God takes out his wrath and his anger on the temple, and the human beings are saved. What if Moses would have built a temple? You can't destroy it. It's too precious. It's almost too imbued with sanctity and holiness. So instead, God would have to take out his wrath on the temple. Ultimately would have been a bad thing for the Jews. Okay.
I didn't think the sign God would make Moses' grave available to the people.
I mean, look at what they did to Jesus. Can you imagine what we would have done to Moses?
No, I was saying they did it on purpose.
Yeah.
What did their reason say?
Alan asked, why wasn't Moses' grave made available, you know, for public knowledge? Why don't we know where Moses is buried?
Because they didn't want people going there and worshiping him.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Maybe
right.
Jim Morrison's grave. We don't need to know where.
That's right. Doesn't matter. Okay, Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53. And again, these are all examples. I encourage you to go through this list. Do this at home. Pull a Bible off the shelf. If you don't have one, you can get it online. But just look up these. And by the way, there is nothing, I mean, you'll have to take my word for it if you don't understand the Hebrew. But the English translations that you're reading are very direct translations from the Hebrew. These are not altered in any way in order to remove any messianic overtones or any references to Jesus. It's not like there's some Hebrew term for Jesus that we just, you know, that just goes untranslated in the English. This is direct from the Hebrew. It's actually a very good translation.
We call him Yashka.
Okay. Yeshaya, Isaiah 53. Who would believe what we have heard? This is 558 in the photocopied Bible here. Who would believe what we have heard? For whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Formerly he grew like a sapling or like a root from arid ground. He had neither form nor grandeur. We saw him, but without such appearance that we could desire him. He was despised and isolated from man, a man of pains and accustomed to illness. He was despised as one from whom we would hide our faces. He was despised, and we had no regard for him. But in truth, it was our ills that he bore and our pains that he carried. But we had regarded him diseased, stricken by God and afflicted. This sounds an awful lot like Jesus. It really does. And it's one of the great... I can't even read this without thinking of Jesus, about someone who was beaten down and who bears the brunt and the iniquity and the sin of the rest of the people, and he's despised. And it's such a travesty that so much of what we actually have in our religion and has always existed in our religion has been hijacked by Christianity and given such overt Christian overtones and feelings to it that it's hard to read our own Tanakh without thinking of Jesus. Now, having said that, you pull away for a minute, and, I mean, we could be speaking about Tevye de Milchiger for all we know, right? A Jew who's despised by everyone else, who's beaten down, who the other Jews don't like, but he just continues to go along and go along. And it sounds like, I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with the passages in the Bible that speak about him. It sounds a lot like Eliyahu HaNavi, a lot like Elijah. Totally unpopular, too harsh, and he just deals with whatever poor lot the people cast upon him. Sounds a lot like Moses, a lot like Moses. And he just goes, and it's the stiff-necked people, and they're mean to him, and they yell at him, and why'd you take us out, Moses? And you got Edward G. Robinson, Moses, why should I stay in Egypt? And it's horrible, and oy, what he has to deal with, and he just keeps going and going and schlepping along and leading the people, and I gave you the mud, and I gave you the water, and he hits the rock, and now I can't go to Israel, and everyone's staying at the panorama but me. I can't believe it. And he's just incensed. This sounds like so many different Jews, great and average, throughout our history. Is it speaking about a Messiah? Maybe. I cannot conceive of a Messiah that would have any different story. I can't. I mean, if Moses was the closest thing we ever had to a messianic figure, that if he were to build a temple, it would never be destroyed, and Moses is the one that, for all history, we put up on a pedestal like no other, I can't imagine there ever being a Messiah, a Jewish Messiah in the future, that doesn't fit the same bill. It could be anybody. I don't see anything about a crucifix. I don't see anything about any of the... You know, he was a carpenter. I mean, give me his address, you know? And he lived on Rehov Ir Ha'atika in the Old City, and he was a carpenter, and he had a little business called, Yashka's Desks or whatever, you know. Nothing like that. Nothing. If it is speaking about a Messiah, which we tend to say that this is, I mean, much of our traditional interpretation of Yeshaya is that, yeah, Isaiah does speak about Messiah, but it's just sort of vague. It gives us the notion that there's such a thing as a Messiah, but that this is talking about any one human being versus any others is just, it's very, very difficult to really buy. Just with a couple of minutes left, just to go through some of the actual points made in at the very top of this page here. Some of these, by the way, I have come across some. Maybe it's even here. Is it this chapter? Own people would reject them, hate him without cause. There was something about actually being placed on a cross. 53:12. At the very end of the second paragraph here, we say that the Messiah would be crucified with thieves and plead for those killing him. Okay? By the way, the notion of the crucifix doesn't come for many, many centuries after Isaiah died. Okay? So there was no term at the time in Isaiah's life. There was no term for a crucifix. Crucifix hadn't been invented yet. There was no crucifixion yet. Wouldn't come for, I think, 4 centuries until after Isaiah's death, at least according to Wikipedia. So, 3 centuries, fine. There would be no term that Isaiah could refer to make reference to it. What you could do, I mean, it's not that difficult to describe. You got a thing here and a thing here. So you'd have to describe it. You have to speak about it. The notion that the Messiah would be crucified with thieves and plead for those killing him. Isaiah 53:12. Check it out for yourselves. 53:12. Therefore, I will, at the very end of the chapter, therefore I will assign him a portion from the multitudes, and he will divide the mighty as spoils in return for having poured out his soul for death and being counted among the wicked. For he bore the sin of the multitudes and prayed for the wicked. I guess that's the quote, that he poured out his soul for death and he was counted among the wicked. Meaning that this person that we speak about would die one day or go through all sorts of horrors and still not get what he really deserved, still not be placed on the pedestal that he ought to have been, still not be appreciated by all those around him. Again, could be speaking about any number of Jews. Could certainly be said about Moses, could be said about Elijah, could be said about any of the great Jews who have ever lived. Could be said about many of the great people who ever lived. How often do we only appreciate the work of an artist until long after he's dead, when we have a little bit of a buffer zone in history to really appreciate his work and his efforts in terms of the generation in which he lived? It's true of many, many people. Certainly don't see anything about a crucifix, that's for sure. And I don't know, it's just very troublesome to me, because there doesn't, aside from the fact that this is a person who will die and not get what he, and not be viewed in the way that he really should have been, it's troublesome because I think, you know, often when we're actually in these conversations, well, you don't have the opportunity to say, hold on a second, let me, you know, pull out the good book and compare and contrast. Just, wow, there's a prophecy in Isaiah about the Messiah being placed up on a crucifix. Oh my God. And it's in the context of the other 60 sources and 60 references that you've also brought. It could be very, very overwhelming. Again, the idea is really just to pull back and to give yourself the opportunity to cross-reference and to double-check and to look through the Bible. Not to cross, correct, right. Not to cross-reference. To double-check. To open
source.
Up the actual Bible and to look for yourselves. Right? Cross-reference, right? Cross. Yeah. Camille, question? No? Jacob.
Actually, according to a lot of Christian scholars, this part of Psalm referring to the nation of Israel instead of other people.
Yeah,
and
great.
They also believe so. And only, well, some of them believe it directed to Jesus, but some of them believe it can be anyone or the nation of Israel.
Yeah, I could certainly, that this could be any one individual.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Certainly sounds that way. Certainly sounds that way. It could be anyone.
I mean, even a lot of Christian scholars.
Good. So. They're coming around. Great. They'll be eating matzo ball soup before you know it. Yeah.
So what is the simple one or two line response to the Christian who says, I'm just trying to save yourself?
Not interested. I hear hell is beautiful this time of year. I'm really a warm weather gal anyway. That's the simple response. And honestly, because the fact is it could just be totally the simple response, and I just never get involved because it's just too... there's absolutely no way to win. Absolutely no way to win. You're dealing with someone who's so, and also, so let's say you're successful, right? Let's say you're successful and you do a fair job in defending Judaism. Have you done that person a favor? This person's great. They're connected to spirituality. They feel like they have a place in the world, and they're there doing the work of God. Wonderful. Gesundheit, hate, enjoy.
Go be well.
Go be well. Go missionize everyone. Great. Find more. Good. Find pagans and turn them into Christians. Oh, that's fine. That's great. I'm not going to spend the time converting pagans. So I have my hands full of Jews. I'm trying to convert Jews into Jews. I don't need to convert pagans into Jews. It's hard enough. So let the missionaries go and find more pagans and convert them into Christians. Wonderful, by all means. But there's no simple response. It's an impossible kind of argument.
It's just a thing.
Because it is so emotionally driven.
Right.
What we need to know is that it is oftentimes as simple as opening up a Bible and just saying, okay, that's an interesting point. I'll take your pamphlet and I'll go look through it at home. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. You know.
I feel like I'm here and the discussion is up there. But what I don't get is where you see signs, Jesus is Lord, Jesus is God, but Jesus is the Son of God.
Oh, I don't know. I cannot begin to explain Christian theology.
Yes, yeah, I don't
have a clue. I don't know.
This Trinity thing.
I don't know. The best response I can offer is understand where this came from, right? Understand historically how Christianity evolved. You're dealing with something that was originally a Jewish concept that portrayed Jesus as a Messiah. The frightening thing, and it's a frightening thing today also, is that the notion of a dead man being Messiah doesn't hold water for all that long. And in order to continue to inspire, continue to perpetuate, and continue to dedicate myself to someone who's dead, that being had better well become divine. Otherwise, there isn't enough inspiration content there anymore. It's a very scary thing for today also. Happened, Shabtai Tzvi ultimately ran his course. He was treated as a false messiah. Even long after he was dead, he was considered to be a messiah, and it spawned a whole new religion. But the fear is that that's really what happens. You start off with a messiah, but he dies, and that doesn't hold my interest for that long. So he has to, per se, develop into a divine figure. How you then figure that out? How could he be Son of God, and how could he be human being, but also be a component of God?
Rabbi,
I don't know.
You should tell who Shabtai Tzvi was.
Who's Shabtai Tzvi? Shabtai Tzvi was a false messiah, during the Middle Ages. Earlier than 17th century. 17th century?
He died in the...
Oh, 17th century. Yeah. 17th century. It didn't come to a close until the 18th century. Lived in Turkey, converted to Islam.
Right.
Yeah. Ultimately, was killed by the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Emperor. But people still continued to believe in him. And then there was like a second coming, and it was a whole...
But that was after he was converted.
Right.
After he converted. He converted. People still... Many still continued to rally behind him, insisting that the convert to Islam was a means of drawing the spirituality out from Islam, and then would offer that as additional spiritual... Again, I'm not here to explain, wacky theologies. But... Sharon, just to help to paint the picture, understand the difficulty. There's a difficulty today, theologically, with understanding Jesus as both Son of God and also God himself. Where that came from is the fact that you begin with a Messiah and then develops into a divine being. Also, when you're trying to appeal to pagans, there has to be some kind of pagan draw. The idea that you can worship a human being or a finite being as a god also is very attractive. But we can't sway too far from monotheism because, after all, we're Jews. So it develops into this very bizarre sort of notion. Something that they tried to get a handle of at the Council of Nicaea, and it still continues to bother Christian theologians. I'm not that bothered by it.
A lot of Protestant sects don't find it.
Sure. But the Catholics don't like the Protestants.
I know.
Yeah, I got my other neighbor's Protestant. It's like, I gotta keep the two apart sometimes. Oh, God. Yeah. It's like my Catholic neighbor, he thinks he's so frum. I wouldn't daven in his shul. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Questions? Yeah.
One thing that Christians say about not having evidence about who Jesus' dad was is that all the records would have been in the temple, which was destroyed afterwards. So they say, ha, the evidence could be there, but it's not there because you were naughty. And the Jews were punished.
Uh-huh.
And they also argue that the Jews were punished because they didn't start following Jesus.
So he did have a human father.
Yes.
So what makes him divine?
Exactly.
Right, so this is right. And look, it's very challenging. You're starting off with the Messiah, and you're trying to reinvent him as a divine being. It gets very tricky. So the theology of it is really impossible. Yeah.
So then, our Messiah, the Jewish, doesn't become a divine being.
No. No, you can't become a divine. You can't become a divine being unless you're God, and that doesn't apply to anyone here. I don't care how wonderful you think you are. No, you can't become a divine being. The whole notion is impossible. The way that we understand monotheism, and the way that Muslims understand monotheism, and the way that Protestants understand monotheism, a human being can't become a divine being. That's ridiculous.
So then, the idea of Moshiach. Everybody then becomes
from.
Yeah, or
Maimonides speaks about him as bringing people to observance and love of Torah and love of God and all those kinds of things.
So
but he's a human being. By the way, I mean, if you have to think about one person, and this is where it gets really, really challenging, and I can appreciate it. If you think about one person in the past 1,000 years, who more than anyone was responsible for a mass return to Judaism, to Jewish values, to observance, was charismatic, was beloved, was a Torah scholar, oral law, written law, everybody loved him, he was humble, he was wonderful. The Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe. I mean, more than anyone, and by the way, also, even more complicated, a direct descendant of King David.
But he's dead.
So that's how the story ends. For some. But he's dead. That's the only...
He died before there's a temple.
Correct. He died before he could accomplish what... Now, does that mean that... By the way, and I brought it up last time briefly. I don't want to get into this too much for those who are unfamiliar. But if you are familiar at all with Bar Kokhba and Rabbi Akiva, so Rabbi Akiva threw his support to Bar Kokhba. Then Bar Kokhba sort of went off a little bit, and then he died, right? Maimonides says that you do X, Y, and Z, and then you can be presumed to be Mashiach, but if you die before you do the rest. So would it have been possible if, had the circumstances been somewhat different, maybe had we been better, had other people come closer, who knows? Would it have been possible for the Lubavitcher Rebbe to have become the Mashiach? Maybe. I mean, he was a scholar, well-respected, beloved, brought people back to observance, charismatic, he was something of a political figure also, he was like a diplomat for the Jewish people. But you know what? Great people die sometimes.
Right.
Usually, actually.
Usually.
Actually,
they all die.
Yeah, at some point.
So where does the notion of when Moshiach comes, the dead shall rise?
Later. The notion of the resuscitation of the dead happens later.
Reach Mona Esrei.
We speak about that actually before the whole unfolds. It's the main body of the Shmona Esrei that deals with the building towards the climax of the Messiah. The last verse is the last blessing of that main body is reflower and re-blossom. Maybe we see a blossoming of the Davidic line, and then it sort of ends there. And we don't at any point ask for the resuscitation of the dead, which is sort of an interesting thing.
Is
But that comes later.
Ask for him, but it says this will happen.
It speaks about God as the resuscitator of the dead. But it's not a formal request that we ask God to please resuscitate the dead. We speak. Well, we ask for the Messiah, but then it ends there.
This part comes right after Romans.
Yeah, but it's not a request. It's not a request.
It's a statement.
Yeah. We it's a praise. It's a praise. Yeah.
So there are people today who can actually trace themselves to David?
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
I know why Cruz says it's
not. Yeah, I mean it's not that difficult. It's not that difficult. I mean it's lost on many of us, but
so
if you
couldn't it all happen again?
What do you mean?
You know, the Magi and the Christmas and the Son will be born and the
meaning, couldn't there be another false Messiah? Sure. Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're living through such an era right now. There are many people who believe right now, aside from Christianity, there is a whole, for lack of a better term, there's an entire splinter sect of Judaism, we have no idea how large or how small, who believe that a dead man is the Messiah. Yeah, absolutely. And he was a descendant of King David, and in his life fulfilled many of the things that we find on Maimonides' list. But not all of them. And he built a temple in Brooklyn.
He's even got an address, 770.
So you get your tribe from your father, how do you figure out what tribe of convert would go into?
So what we say now is Israel. How you actually, it's much more generic than that, right? It's much easier. How you determine it, an actual tribe, I'm not sure. Meaning how they would have done it at a time when you had specific tribes, I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. Maybe it's like, you know, here, when there's like an indigent burial, so like there's a round robin, like each one of the synagogues has to deal with it. So maybe it was like when there's a new convert in, okay, Zebulun, it's your turn. Like, oh, man. Nope, that. Yisachar did it last time. Yeah, okay, fine. No, nonsense. Yeah, we don't define it as being a different component of God. It's God's presence manifest in the world, which, by the way, is all. I mean, theologically, it's like a very difficult concept to wrap your head around. How could an infinite being occupy physical space? He can't. Right? We say God is everywhere. God's not everywhere. God's nowhere. God doesn't occupy physical space. He's not contained within this world. He is beyond the world. So what exactly Shekhinah is, what divine presence is, what it means that God's presence rests on the Ark of the Covenant, on the Temple Mount, in the temple, I don't know. But it doesn't mean that there is an additional component to God. It's that God somehow or another, burning bush and whatever, makes his, he has like, you know, you see your God's fingerprints, you know, left on the earth somehow. I don't know what that means exactly. There's a lot about God that I don't understand. It's not like theology and understanding God in any religion is simple. It's just that in Christianity, it's impossible. Actually impossible.
Well, I tell people it's our mortal attempt to describe all the various influences of God, because we can't do it.
But it's more than that, because God himself speaks about it. Right, God speaks about speaking to Moses from on top of the lid of the ark, and he tells us about there being a burning bush, and the voice of God emanates from, there's an angel, and I don't know, but it's one God. I don't know. I mean, look, just we say that when we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, God is one. Not only that God is one as opposed to many, God is unified. God is all-encompassing. It is not as though God is sometimes he's angry, and sometimes he's and sometimes he's happy, and sometimes he's sweet, and sometimes he's sensitive and emotional, and he has hot flashes, and he has hormones, and, I mean, God doesn't operate that way. God is always one, and we perceive him as being different at different points of the year, day, whatever. But I can't really understand that or explain that, but God's not easy to understand. That's I think, the biggest take-home message. So again, I hope this left everyone with at least the confidence to please take a Bible off the shelf, look through some of these sources, look through other sources as they come up, and know that it's not really that difficult to dispel some of these claims that are made by missionaries and the like, and the situation can be diffused rather easily if you just take the time to open up the book. Have a good day, everyone.